We kind of ended there, a little ominous ending that we had there. It's kind of like the ending of Mark. So this is Luke's version of the empty tomb story. And, you know, if you look at the first encounter with the empty tomb and compare it in the other Gospels, the details are always a little different. But all four Gospels all agree that it was women that were there. It was Jesus's female disciples that found the empty tomb in every case. It was these women who were the first evangelists. They were the first ones to share the good news of Christ, the first to report of the resurrection. What a great honor. In here, looking at the setting, here the women are, is my clicker going to work? Maybe not. Can we go to the next slide? Thank you. So these women are in Luke. It gives us three names: Mary Magdalene, Joanna, and Mary, the mother of James. However, verse 10 says that there was others with them, implying that maybe there was even more. May have been a pretty big group of women, but we only get certain names. Each gospel author only gives certain names. So Luke 8 gives us a little bit more of the backstory on these women, just a little bit. So we know Mary Magdalene and Joanna, they were healed of evil spirits by Jesus, and they traveled with the disciples as if they themselves were disciples. They traveled with these men, which was scandalous. I think we need to acknowledge that. That wasn't normal. Women didn't travel with disciples. Jesus was doing something radical here by including them in as disciples and being part of this mission. But one thing that I find ironic is Luke 8 tells us that Joanna was married to Herod's accountant, to Herod's house manager. And then it says that these women helped fund the mission. So if you think about it, remember Herod, he's the one who's afraid of Jesus. He's the one who's afraid of this guy who people are making these claims that he's going to be the king of the Jews. And here he is indirectly funding Jesus and the disciples through Joanna, who's helping fund this. Interesting. And then you got Mary, the mother of James, which Mary was a really common name back then. There's lots of Marys. It can be confusing. It's kind of like the name Mary is today. So we don't really know who this is. It says Mary, the mother of James. And so some people, that you could guess maybe this is Mary, the mother of Jesus, and James, the brother. Probably not. They probably would have said Mary, the mother of Jesus. So who's James? What James are we talking about here? It's probably not talking about Mary, the mother of what history knows as James the Great. Now, James the Great is the guy who is the brother of Jesus, the guy who becomes the head guy, the head apostle or the head leader of the Church of Jerusalem, the guy who the epistle of James is attributed to. That's James the Great. This is Mary, the mother of James, probably son of Alphaeus. We all know who that is, right? No, you don't. I don't know who he is. All we know is he was one of the 12. And that's about all we know of James, son of Alphaeus. So, unfortunately, James, son of Alphaeus, actually got the unfortunate nickname James the Less. And so anytime, and you know, it's probably really unfortunate for this guy. Anytime people ran into him, they'd be like, oh, you're James. James the Great, you're the brother of Jesus. You're the leader in Jerusalem. And then he'd be like, actually, I'm James the Less. Wah, wah, wah. And then they'd be, but I was a disciple. And then they would do like, kind of like they do to like Ant-Man. They would be like, oh, could you get me James the Great's autograph? That would be awesome. So this guy, James the Less, his mom actually gets more time in the Gospels than he does because she was here at the empty tomb. And so really all this to say, these women showing up here, they were significant, instrumental in the life and ministry of Jesus, and I bet they were very important to him. And so the setting is important, the people there are important, the time is important. It was Sunday morning. This is why Sunday morning is called the Lord's Day. It's because it was when the resurrection happened. It was when Jesus was resurrected. And it's really why the church meets during that time. But it was in the morning, early morning. This picture is too bright. It would have been dark, maybe at dawn. And so the early church would replicate that. The early church, that's, we think, this is why they met so early in the morning. If you look at early historical sources, they met before dark. They met before the sun came up. So Westgate, it ain't happening. That would be very difficult for us to meet that early. But the early church, they met that early. But it was Sunday. Because, and of course, they wouldn't call it Sunday because that's Sunday, even the words are to the sun god. They would not have called it that. But it was the day before the Sabbath. And you can't work on the Sabbath. You can't go prepare a body. You can't put the spices on the body on the Sabbath. That's work. And so these women were present at the crucifixion, a moment so horrible, so traumatic, so crushing, that really there's no way to explain it. There's no way to describe what these women felt witnessing this. But then the Saturday, the Sabbath, the next day, that may have been the worst day ever. Definitely it was the worst Sabbath ever. It was a day of grief. But you can't even just begin to describe the grief that they felt. And they couldn't work. They couldn't do anything to take their minds off of it. They just had to sit there and wallow in that pain. They saw a loved one and a friend tortured and killed right before their eyes. But it was more than the loss of a friend. It was the loss of a movement. It was the loss of hope. It was the loss of what they thought was going to be an earth-shattering, world-changing event. When they saw Jesus die, they lost all of that. Their hope was gone. And so on that Sabbath, I bet it was hard for them to even pray. Maybe they didn't. They probably wondered if God even cared. They probably wondered if God got beat, if he wasn't as powerful as they thought. And so for some in the Christian world, and this moment of utter despair, depression, loss of faith, distance from God, wondering if he's even there, it sometimes ends up being called the dark night of the soul. It's based on a poem by St. John of the Cross where he speaks of this. It sounds scary, right? It sounds like an emo band. But it's a time of doubt, a time of spirit. I like the term spiritual dryness, where nothing feels spiritual. It's all mind and no heart, all logic and no sense of wonder. In a dark night of the soul, maybe you feel like your prayers aren't going anywhere, like they're just bouncing off the walls. And with that comes this doubt and this spiritual dryness, and you feel separated from God, but then you feel alone in it. It's a lonely time where you feel disconnected. And like we talked to Sunday morning or in Sunday morning Bible class, that it's so important to have that connection with the community. But maybe you've been in a drought like this, in a dark night of the soul, where, and maybe it's not just a day, maybe it's spread out over a season, where you don't even know what you believe anymore, where you're not sure about God, where you're wondering where God is, how he works, feeling like he's not getting through to you anymore. And in all these feelings, you feel so separated from God and others. I think these ladies probably felt that, and maybe, and then some, on that Sabbath before the resurrection, on that day of grieving. And not always. This isn't a hard and fast rule. But if you're in a place of this dark night of the soul, feeling this separation, oftentimes, not always, oftentimes, it's associated with or comes after a bad event that shakes you to your core. Something bad in your life that happens that causes you to doubt everything. That causes you to think, maybe I've done a grave miscalculation. Maybe my worldview is completely off. And so one I've seen a lot that might cause this is when there's a spiritual exemplar that you kind of look to that maybe shaped you when you see them have a moral failure? When there's a maybe a minister or a Christian friend and you see, oh, they really messed up. I feel like I was lied to. What else was I lied to about? And you can kind of go down into this kind of dark area in your life. Or maybe sometimes it's from tragedy, where maybe there's this bad thing, a loss in your family or loss of a friend, where you think, that always happened to somebody else. These things don't happen to me. And when those things happen, you start recalculating everything and start second-guessing everything. What else was I wrong about? What else do I not know about? So it's this time of unknowns and rethinking and re-guessing about everything and not knowing what you believe anymore and then feeling alone in that. It's a really difficult time to be in. And so I wonder if that's how they felt on the Sabbath, rethinking who is God. But then again, not a hard and fast rule about going through this dark night of the soul is that oftentimes it comes before a great revelation or a spiritual reawakening, maybe just a spiritual awakening. And it's in this retooling and reworking in this kind of dark place where maybe we let go of some of the things. Maybe we let go of the parts of God we were mistaken about. Because it's in this dark night of the soul and this separation where maybe you realize you've been putting up these bounds on God and who He is. You've kind of put God in a little bit of a box. And anyone who I've seen come out of this dark night of the soul, of this depressing, dark, lonely place, anyone who I've seen come out of it, they always come out realizing God is much bigger than they thought He was. And that is a good thing. It is a beautiful thing to realize I've shortchanged God. I've said He's something that He's not. And now I realize who God really is. He is much bigger than I have imagined. I have put way too many bounds on how He works. I've subjected Him to way too many rules that He doesn't have to follow. God is bigger than I thought. And so for those of us that may be in this place, that is my prayer. That we realize God is more capable and His reach goes much further than we ever imagined. That's what happened to these ladies. That's what happened to these ladies at the empty tomb. They go there to mourn, but are shocked when they run into these two angels, these two messengers, additional witnesses to the resurrection of Christ. The biggest moment in history. And they go there and they don't see a body, but the angels, these messengers say, why do you seek the living among the dead? And again, these ladies, their world is rocked because at this point they know something's different. Jesus's work apparently isn't done. The story isn't over, but it's kind of at a point of mystery. And they're again in the process of experiencing something so big, so profound, so powerful, that again, they have to rethink everything that they ever felt or believed. God just keeps surprising them. He keeps breaking the boundaries that they put on Him. Even the disciples are shocked at the idea of the resurrection. They knew He was big, but they didn't know He was that big. He was that powerful. And the angels remind them. They say, hey, remember He told you this. He told you that He would be resurrected, implying that when He had some of these teachings that we see earlier in the Gospel of Luke, that these women were there. They were His disciples. They were being taught. They were being educated like the men were. And He says, I told you this. And it's interesting because oftentimes you have to sit back and remember the past to make sense out of the present. They needed to remember Jesus' words from the past to make sense out of what's going on, to see the promise fulfilled. Sometimes God's words and actions make so much more sense in hindsight. Jesus says something or the Psalms say something and we don't know how to make sense of that until Jesus appears. That was a common thing that the New Testament evangelists and disciples did, is they said, hey, look at Psalms. You don't know how to make sense out of this, but if you look at it in the light of Jesus, this makes a lot of sense. And so the angels are saying, remember what he said, and that'll make sense out of your presence. So out of the presence. So remembering what God has done is very important as we look to the future. And so these women, they go and they tell the disciples. But the disciples don't believe them. And it's not because they're sexist and they don't believe women. It's because it's hard to believe. The resurrection is hard to believe. It requires you to rethink and reorient everything you know about life and death, about what you've perceived, about the way you take in information, about spirituality, about who Jesus is, about who God is. It is a belief that reorients your worldview. It's a shocking story. But this is why belief in the resurrection changes you. And so the scripture that we read kind of ends on a cliffhanger. You know Jesus' body is gone, but you don't really know yet that he's been fully resurrected. We know how the story ends. We know soon they meet the resurrected Jesus. Soon, all of their darkness and doubt turns to joy. Soon, a new view on life and death and the resurrected Jesus. Soon, they are so convinced, they are so shaped, they are so changed that they themselves are willing to die for this cause. So when we look at this death to life experience of Christ, of his disciples, the death to life experience of us, I want you to take away a few things here. The journey of faith, the journey to faith, it's a difficult one. It has ups and downs. It has dark moments. But it's a beautiful one. In the journey of faith, there will be hurt feelings. There will be pain. There will be doubt. There will be loss. There will be a breaking of pride. But God will keep surprising us. He will keep breaking the boundaries that we put on him. And that's a good thing. And like I said, sometimes we focus on the bad, the areas we lack, and we slowly lose faith in God. The ladies went to the tomb expecting a body, not a full, spiritual, earth-shaking revival. So we too need to learn to believe God, to remember the good things he's done in our past so that we can expect big things from God in our future. We need to learn to wait on him patiently in the hard moments, knowing he will come through. The moments of darkness do not last forever. And on the other side of that is life, beauty, and revival. If you're here this morning and you want to experience that life, if you want to experience this love, if you want to experience this community and the forgiveness and grace that God offers, we invite you to come now, as together we stand and sing.